Welcome everyone to the Red Journal podcast. My name is Jasmohan Bajaj. I'm the co-EIC of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And on behalf of my other co-EIC, Dr. Millie Long from UNC, I'm delighted to have Dr. Anne Pieri, who's one of the senior authors, the recently published Acute Diverticulitis Guideline that is now online in the Red Journal. Welcome, Dr. Pieri.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this is a very exciting guideline, and it seems to have covered really essentially the waterfront in terms of acute diverticulitis. But that having been said, could you start by summarizing the most significant changes or shifts in clinical practice that clinicians will find in these recommendations?
Sure. So we wrote the guideline for gastroenterologists who are caring for these patients in clinic. These patients are often referred for a number of different reasons. Sometimes they are looking for help with their diet. Sometimes they want advice on what to do to prevent recurrent episodes, or they're worried about the next episode. So the guideline is really intended to help address all of those common scenarios that we see in GI clinic. We think it provides a really practical framework for confirming a diagnosis, for educating our patients, for avoiding common pitfalls, and recognizing when a surgical referral is appropriate. So to our knowledge, there's really like nothing like this in the literature.
That is really helpful. And as we're going to talk about, there are certain changes about antibiotic use and surgical intervention that are very firmed up here that is actually very clear to the reader. Specifically, the natural history in different terms are very well defined. Could you give a brief outline to our listeners about diverticulosis, uncomplicated and complicated diverticulitis, because obviously that has a lot of therapeutic connotations, and SCAD?
Sure. So diverticulosis, those are the pockets that develop in the wall of the colon. They're quite common, particularly in older adults, but most people with diverticulosis will never develop a complication. Uncomplicated diverticulitis is inflammation only in a diverticulum. Complicated diverticulitis is actually a pretty big bucket and can include any number of complications. So that could be a phlegmon, could be an abscess, perforation. There are actually delayed complications of diverticulitis like strictures and fistulas. And then SCAD. SCAD is really an outlier here. It's its own disease. That's segmental colitis associated with diverticulosis. So it is a type of colitis in the colon where there are diverticulosis.
And this is important because we, especially for gastroenterologists taking care of these patients, the division between complicated and uncomplicated diverticulitis really has a lot of therapeutic and prognostic implications. And going from there, antibiotic use has been narrowed. Can you tell us in which situations these are still recommended or not? Because we are often very trigger happy when it comes to prescribing antibiotics for these patients.
Sure. So in otherwise healthy patients or in the outpatient setting, if they have mild uncomplicated diverticulitis, antibiotics are often not needed. So that includes patients who are immunocompetent, they're stable, they have no signs of any sort of complication or systemic inflammation. They can eat, they can drink, they're not frail in any way, and they have good, reliable follow-up. We still do recommend antibiotics for patients who are in the hospital, for patients who are immunocompromised, have any sort of complication, are clinically unstable, they can't tolerate oral intake, or are otherwise higher risk.
So yeah, this is a really important differentiation because most of us are, you know, have the dogma that, you know, if you have diverticulitis, the next stop is, you know, after the imaging is actually giving antibiotics. So this guideline really makes it very clear into the selected situations where this actually might happen. And then you can save patients from getting unnecessary antibiotic exposure. But it's also interesting, important to know that, you know, in patients, immunocompromised people, as well as those who even have a hint of having like a complications, and complications, as you noted, are very, very broad, like almost anything beyond the situation that you said is a complication. Do you want to actually tell us a little bit more about the complications, what they could include? I know you briefly touched upon them, but it spans a lot of things.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So those patients who have diverticulitis and there's gas, say, seen on CT imaging outside the colon, or a phlegmon or an abscess, we are certainly not going to withhold antibiotics from those patients. Those patients do need antibiotics and potentially even a surgery consult to co-manage them. So those are patients who are appropriate.
Great. There is also a very great patient education session section here. And we know we will have a patient podcast definitely, but this is also for us to educate our patients. Could you go over that a little bit in this?
Yeah, thank you. We wrote this section to address the most common questions that patients ask in clinic. I actually had a patient review the section after we wrote it just to get feedback because it was so important to us. The main themes are diet because patients often want very specific guidance. They want to know what to eat when they're having an episode. They want to know what to eat when they've recovered. The natural history was also really important to us because I think understandably, these patients are really worried about their future and are they going to go on to develop a perforation or need emergency surgery? So we covered all of that. Patients often want advice on what they can do to prevent recurrences. So we address that. Our hope is that we've given patients a pretty complete guide on understanding their condition and managing it.
Thank you. And I think this is such a brilliant addition to the guidelines. And for the listeners, it's table 5 of the guidelines. So it's something that you might want to just print out and keep on your as a handout. And it is actually written in that way. So it is really appreciated. So when would we consider surgical intervention in diverticulitis?
So for those patients who have recurrent diverticulitis and it's impacting their quality of life, those are the patients that you want to refer to a surgeon. It's really important, though, if you're going to send these patients to a surgeon that the diagnosis is confirmed, ideally with at least one CT scan. You don't want to send a patient who's never had imaging to a surgeon. It's also important that we as gastroenterologists not overpromise, because surgery is not a cure and it does carry risks. It's also important that surgery is not recommended in those patients who are just young or have had a certain number of episodes. We don't count episodes of diverticulitis anymore. And it should not be advised solely to prevent an abdominal catastrophe in the future. That's not why we do elective resection anymore.
Now, this is an important departure from what people have been taught for a long time, because like, second episode, third episode, and then you're kind of like counting, okay, this one was in the sigmoid, that other one was in the descending colon. So which segment of the colon needs to come out? And so those are all things that like frustrate the patient and of course us as well. And definitely the surgeons, once we give them an unclear diagnosis or a diagnosis that is like piecemeal across several admissions. So what is the clarity that you offer at this stage with this?
That's a great point. I do have patients who have a history of basically multifocal diverticulitis, and I am very careful in understanding each episode, what the imaging has shown, are their symptoms consistent? Are we trying to manage diverticulitis that has occurred in different segments of colon? Because what you don't want to do is send them to the surgeon, they resect the sigmoid, but really they've also been having diverticulitis in the descending colon. That would be incredibly disappointing for everyone.
Another question that comes up is colonoscopy. So when is a colonoscopy indicated in these patients with diverticulitis?
Sure. So we recommend colonoscopy after recovery from complicated diverticulitis. And the reason that we do that is because we want to make sure we're not missing cancer or a pre-malignant lesion. In patients with uncomplicated diverticulitis, their risk of a missed cancer is very, very, very low. So colonoscopy is only suggested in patients who have a history of uncomplicated diverticulitis if they're not current with colon cancer screening or if they have alarm symptoms. If you are going to do a colonoscopy in a patient with a history of diverticulitis, you want to wait 6 to 8 weeks after the episode because that inflammation really can make the colonoscopy technically difficult and increases the risk of complications.
That is very useful information. There's also a bunch of things not to do. And a lot of this has permeated the zeitgeist of whenever you talk about diverticulitis. You briefly mentioned about popcorn and nuts and seeds and stuff like that. Could you, and this is a very nice section in which you risk being someone who just keeps on saying no all the time, but I think this is actually a good thing for patients so that their diets, et cetera, are not restricted. Could you briefly go over things that have very low evidence, so therefore we should not ask patients to avoid or take, that you've listed in the guideline?
Sure. So In patients with a history of acute diverticulitis, we recommend against using probiotics, mesalamine or faxamin, to reduce the risk of recurrence. There's actually great data from several randomized trials that mesalamine is not effective at preventing recurrence. And then the evidence for using probiotics and rifaximin is very, very poor. We shouldn't be recommending those to our patients. There's no evidence that they'll be helpful. With regards to diet, there is that sort of old adage that nuts and seeds are going to get stuck in the diverticulum and precipitate diverticulitis. But there have been a few well-done observational studies that have found no association between consuming that sort of particulate matter and developing diverticulitis. So patients really don't need to restrict their diet in that way.
Who will tell us? Everyone else to tell them not to do that. It's easier said than done. It's almost like part of, you know, our culture right now is if you see a diverticulum, avoid popcorn.
Right.
This is good for people. You also have things about, you know, just general health, including, you know, alcohol, smoking, as well as overweight, etc., which are also useful. But, you know, again, easier said than done, like physical activity, etc. We'll see whether with GLP-1s this actually makes a difference or not. And maybe this is something that you can help us figure out in the future. So the other thing that we had briefly mentioned before was SCAD, which, you know, even though it's a separate disease, since you did put it in the guideline, I thought it was fair game for us to actually talk about a little bit, because you did put it as a distinct syndrome. So how do you manage that, and how do you separate it from acute diverticulitis or other situations that may actually be confused, like inflammatory bowel disease?
Yeah, so SCAD, again, is segmental colitis associated with diverticulosis. It is a type of colitis. It should be inflammation surrounding the diverticulum. It should spare the rectum. And I think it's really important that if you're making a diagnosis, these patients actually have symptoms and it's not just an incidental finding on colonoscopy. It's relatively uncommon. It's poorly studied, so it's difficult to give great advice on SCAD. There are many smart people who believe it is on the spectrum of inflammatory bowel diseases, and it is managed as such, which I think is totally reasonable. We mention it in the guideline, but we didn't really address it because we do think it is very separate from diverticulitis.
Yeah, I think it just has that word, so that it kind of swept up into this whole thing. But I think the critical point here is that if you just incidentally find it during colonoscopy, but the patient has absolutely no symptoms, then you perhaps want to maybe leave it alone or not tell the patient, of course, but figure it out so that it doesn't look like that's the be-all and end-all of everything, and that it is actually truly distinct from acute diverticulitis and currently distinct from the traditional so-called IBD syndromes that we know. It's a thing in evolution, is that correct? Well, thank you, Dr. Peary. I forgot to say Dr. Peary is professor of medicine in University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and she is part of the whole team, among many others, who were very instrumental in actually putting this guideline together. And I thank you for your time here, and please read this colonic diverticulitis guideline in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. It is currently in press. Thank you.